I've got a short, easy question and a longer question. The short, easy one is, there's a lot of information here, and a lot of really good information here. I really appreciate how you talk about how new people cost the state money and don't help the state situation, which you had an op-ed too. It's very useful. Is this on the borough website that we can access this?
We're going to put it on the borough website. You'll see some of these slides
some of these slides that were put in were put in by Scott Goldsmith. He was at our town hall meeting in Kenai, and I asked him to look at it to sort of lend some of his credibility to what we were saying, and he actually joined us for the Kenai town hall. So we're trying to get to a final version, and it will be on the website.
Yeah, we'll try to get it.
I found Robin Brenna, who's an expert in all this, to have really helpful perspectives too. And he talks about, in terms of the need of getting more revenue, that you either get it from the oil industry, or you get it from us, or you get it from our children, which I think is a real helpful perspective. Whereas when you say, well, we get it from taxes, like income taxes, or we can get it from the permanent fund dividend cuts, as if those were two different things, well, those are us, they're both us. And it's just a question then of how much from each of us. And you had the economics minor. If you cut the permanent fund dividend, well, that's not called the same thing as tax, but the effect is exactly the same. So in terms of economics, the effect is the same as a tax. It's the same as taxing every person $1,000. So I would say, why are we looking at this permanent fund dividend cuts instead of looking more at the graduate income?
Well, and I will give you my opinion on why we're doing that. And the reason we're doing it is because the only spending decision we're making of earnings of the permanent fund is to pay dividends. I mean, we do pay for inflation proofing also, but it's an appropriation. And so that's our biggest actual spending decision in the state, is to pay out a dividend. And at the same time, if you recall those slides that show where we spend our money, education, health, and social services. So while it's a very regressive way to get funds, because it impacts the lowest income folks in rural areas in particular, because there are almost no economy out there, but they're also the lower income are also the ones who are most directly affected by Medicaid cuts. And everybody who is currently going through our public school system is impacted by cuts to school. And you know, one of the points I made to, and it was actually made by my brother Tim, who's on the school board, but I've used it since then, was that, you know, the kids who are in school now, when we cut the education for the kids who are in school now, or cut the funding and it affects their education, they don't get a do-over. They transition through, and even if we add funding later, it doesn't help the ones who are going through our system now. And as expensive it is, Jim was talking about the 11 kids being the reason that we had to build new schools. My mom and some of her teacher friends used to go head to head all the time over the cost of education. And my mom said, well, we pay teachers too much. I think we don't pay teachers enough. But education is very expensive. There are changes we can make to our educational system. And we have to. We have to evolve in that process too. But ignorance is also exceptionally expensive if you look at our corrections budget and our public safety budget. So there's no easy options. All of them, as you correctly pointed out, have implications, economic implications. And yes, we can get more money for oil, but then we just ride that slope down, because we will disincentivize investment in order to get that turned around. If we get it turned around and the prices spike, you know, we can always dial back on the taxes that we pay for income or sales taxes, broad-based taxes or things like that. You know, we can make those types of decisions. We've done it before. We used to have an income tax. I'm old enough to have paid an income tax in the state of Alaska. It was repealed. Last income tax was 79. Repealed in 80.
Repealed in 80 back to 70. Yeah. 70 was the last year.
Yeah.
Maybe just quickly to answer that. So you're right, there's this great philosophical battle going on in Alaska. Should we cut everyone's dividend? Should we give people the dividend and then go hire 50 people to tax some of it back. It's a battle or a philosophical debate that's probably been brewing for years and it's finally coming to a head. I was talking the other day to an Anchorage legislator, Republican, who I will not name, who said, well, everybody gets the equivalent of three dividends. You look at what we spend on Medicaid and schools and dividends, that's the equivalent of three dividends per person. We got to cut that. In her mind, that's what we need to cut, not an income tax. So I guess it's a nice way of saying maybe Homer's not necessarily politically representative of the other 735,000 Alaskans, but it's great you're engaged because there's going to be a lively debate of dividends, income tax, budget cuts, and that's what we're seeing now.
And while we're on that topic, unless we get this balance correct, it's going to have a drag on our economy in Alaska, which means opportunities, not just for folks who are here now, but for the next generation. You know, I was in a drinking establishment, and...
Licensed, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was. And I had a young man who was very upset about what's going to happen. He said, when I was in high school just a few years ago, most of my... he was from Nikiski, said most of my friends and classmates, they got jobs in the oil industry, but some of them have been laid off. You know, what are we going to do? What's my generation? He was 24 years old. He said, what's my generation going to do? Can you assure me that things are going to be okay? And I said, you know, Alaska really is still a relatively young state. We have a lot of opportunities here, whether it's natural beauty and fishing and outdoor stuff, or our natural resources in mining and oil and things like that. There's a lot of opportunities still, but we got to get it right, or it's going to be a drag on our economy. And so that's why, and it has a direct relationship, as I've shown, to the Kenai Peninsula. Because we get a lot of funding from the state. If we didn't get that from the state, if they shifted half of that cost to the local, if they shifted half of it and said, we can't pay this much anymore, you're going to have to pick up half of that would be about 5 cents additional in sales tax if we wanted to increase sales taxes, or it would be about 6 mils, an increase of 6 mils in our property taxes to cover that cost.
You have. I was here when we paid income taxes, too, originally, and I do remember when people were arguing. I was in the planning profession, municipal government and state government, DNR, and Ketchikan and Anchorage, and I remember how hard people were trying to get an economic development plan for the state, a long-range fiscal plan, and it's just like you're saying, every time somebody else, a new administration came in, that went out the window, and I remember your efforts on it. I remember Lisa Murkowski trying to... and I was really impressed at that time with her work then. Things are different now. And it was, I think it was really a huge mistake, and I thought even then, even though I was really young and naive, I really thought it was then really wrong to get rid of the income tax, because if you're not paying an income tax to your state, your feeling of responsibility to the state and the responsibility of the state to you is very different. You know, we turned into very much a welfare state, and I think that's just really sad, and that has something to do with why we're here now. But also, what was happening at that time, I remember Governor Hammond was doing Alaska Public Forums, and there were community discussions happening all over. Do you remember that? It was a great effort, and people were really talking about the issues, and we're talking about them across party lines. You know, it wasn't about party at that time. We had huge decisions to be made about the permanent fund, about land disposals from the feds to the state to the local. There were big decisions to be made, and we all got together in these public forums that were broadcast on public television across the state, so you could see what was happening, and people got to even vote in some of the, you'd be sitting in Ketchikan watching the public forum that was actually being taped with your mayor, your planning director at the time, was me. And people could vote and get consensus in. And it was great because really important decisions were being made. And they're being made for the welfare of everybody. And people felt differently about them, but the discussions were rich. And I think it ended up in a lot of good decisions. The decision to get rid of the income tax, I think, was a really poor decision. I really am in favor of the income tax now because a lot of us, like right now, I just recently retired. I have a very nice purse. You know, I was tier one.
Were you married?
Yeah, well, I'm already married. It was helpful. There's no income tax on that. I'm over 65. I'm not paying borough property tax.
I tried to change.
I know, and I agree with you on that. This is all wrong. There needs to be an income tax because there are a lot of us who are staying in the state. We're being paid extra to stay in the state by PERS. And so we need to be taxed. There needs to be an income tax. And, you know, there are people also that I ended up changing professions and ended up going into mental health, and I've been here for 9 years. And I was really amazed with how many people are moving into the state from California and other places to retire here. So that, you know, that income needs to be taxed, and we need to be paying for the schools. And a property tax, but I think the state needs to do an income tax. And I think we need to be having really frank discussions about it. And I think, and this is actually leading to a question, is because you have been involved for so long in this state in all the different iterations at a time when we could all talk across party lines, and then a time now when it seems to be very divided, except for people that are good enough like Paul Seaton to go and to the other side to kind of try to deal with this issue. You know, how do we get there again? How do we go back to where we can have conversations that aren't about, if you don't agree with me, well, getting to a local issue, I'm going to do a recall petition, you know? But where we can disagree, come to consensus, and go on. How do we get there again? Because that was a wonderful time as a young adult.
Quite frankly, it's going to be difficult. And it's going to require that we go back to civil discourse. And, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And, you know, a lot of the talk radio that's out there, whether it's the liberal end or the conservative end, they misrepresent things because they're entertainers. And they do a great job of entertaining, but the result is that there's a lot of uninformed or misinformed folks. And it makes it much harder on people who are in office trying to do their job because they get attacked for little things. And the other thing is that is difficult is that it's hard to get people who want to go into those systems and to run because it's way different now. Paul Ostrander, who was the chief of staff before Larry, is now the city manager at the city of Kenai. I encouraged him because I'm finished in October because I'm termed out. We have term limits. I encouraged him, but he was thinking about running for the state legislature. And he would have been great. Paul is objective, he's intelligent, he's got a good decision-making process. He would have been great. He asked me, you know, I'm thinking about maybe running for the legislature. What do you think? And I said, boy, Paul, it would be great for us, for your constituents, for the state, because you would be a rational voice, a good legislator who would work on issues, not politics. I said, but I don't think it'd be good for you. And so I found myself talking him out of it because of some of the experience that I've seen and some of what's become so toxic in that system. And I don't mean to say that we need good people to run, and there are a lot of good people in the legislature, but they're just come from different perspectives and different backgrounds. And so what we have to do is not always elect people who are telling us what we want to hear. We have to try to elect people, and it's difficult because it's much easier to attack someone than it is. And so when you see people who you think are telling you what they think you need to hear or what the issues are that they're versus someone who's telling you what you want to hear, make the distinction, write letters to the editor, talk to your friends and neighbors. You know, there's elections happen every year. Either local or state elections, and so it's tough. It's and vetting the candidates, and then if we could get some of the money out of politics, it would be better. It used to drive me crazy when I was running for the state house. I was also on the raising money for the Boys and Girls Club Board, which I was on, hospice, in the Women's Resource Center. And so I do a golf tournament every year. And I struggle, and it sometimes raises as much as $15,000 or $20,000. I mean, just like pulling teeth to get money to do this. And then I'd run for the legislature, and one year I raised, running for the legislature, I raised $97,000. I spent, I think, almost that amount because it was a very close election. I almost lost. That's when they took Homer out of my district, put me in with Nikiski and Girdwin and Indian and Hope. And with 10 out of 11 precincts reporting, I was losing by 60 votes, but fortunately the last precinct was Girdwood, and they bailed me out, so.
How do you recommend we change the narrative? I graduated high school here 20 years ago, and there wasn't much incentive to stay in the state besides enjoying the beauty and the prospect that you could create your own business and make it that way. How can we change the narrative in politics regarding not being top-heavy with relying on oil companies and encouraging families and young people to stay and invest and keep and further make our state great? Because I have a young family, we have four small children, and it's still in the back of my mind, it would be so much easier to live in the lower 48 because it is hard economically here. But what keeps us here is the wonderful community and the environment, and yet we have to feel like we have to claw, scrape, just to make ends meet. How can we change the narrative that we don't have that in our mind, that it's never a question? Why should we leave? Why should we even think about leaving?
You know, I think that's something that we've got to get a rational economic base, because if we don't, then we will rely on oil and gas revenues in order to try to support us. And if we try to rely too heavy on them, it's going to be a disincentive to the investment that it takes. And so you've got to try to strike that balance. And right now, because it's a fairly new phenomena that in Alaska that we've got a budget problem, we're still at the initial stages of sort of grappling with what choices we're going to make in order to provide what I talked about earlier is opportunity. In order to have opportunity, you've got to have a stable economic base. Otherwise, you're going to get pulled up and down, and you may be very successful initially as an entrepreneur, but if the economy crashes and contracts too much, your opportunity goes away very quickly. And it's one of the things that scares me. You know, I'm a part of a family company, LLC. Actually, we're a sub-S, but they don't pay taxes in Alaska either. But it's really with my 10 siblings, and some of them live in the lower 48, and they pay taxes in their state on income earned by our company in Alaska because we don't have an income tax. If we set up an income tax, it would mean about, and you know, nobody likes income taxes. I don't want to pass taxes just because I like taxes. Nobody really likes taxes. It's about getting a strong economic base. And so, and a point I meant to make earlier with respect to the budget plan that the Senate currently is kind of relying on, and they've been making presentations about, and I have a lot of friends in the state Senate. They're saying that their projections show that using earnings of the permanent fund and oil prices going back up and $600 or $700 million in budget cuts over the next several years, we don't need to do taxes. We don't need to have any broad-based taxes. But what they don't have in that is any scenarios for inflationary growth in the budget. They also don't have factored into their equation, you know, the capital budget in the state of Alaska. The general fund portion of the capital budget just a few short years ago was $3 billion a year. $3 billion a year. And that last several years, it's only been enough to match the federal highway money. So it's only been about $100 or $115 million a year. Significant change. And it takes about 5 years for capital budget dollars to funnel through the economy. And we haven't backfilled any of that. So that's why we're seeing construction jobs that are going down. The only bright spot that we hear about is in healthcare. Well, all these other sectors are going down, but healthcare, look, it's still going up. Fact of the matter is healthcare is not sustainable, and healthcare requires a strong economy, or it also will struggle and collapse.
Something I think that's kind of related to what you asked and others. So as you think about budget cuts, sales tax, income tax, permanent fund dividend, using some permanent fund earnings, a lot of people have thought, what does the least damage to the economy and what does the most damage? Because certainly if you take money out of the economy, whether it's taxes, lay people off, it's going to hurt the economy, and we don't want to do that any more than you have to. Laying off a public employee is the worst. If you're laying off someone who gets paid $50,000 a year, most of that money is spent in the state. You just pull that out of the economy. If you have an income tax, much of that income tax will be paid by non-residents who work here. So that's an advantage to that. Sales tax, certainly visitors will pay some sales tax. Probably not as much as you would get from an income tax on non-residents, because if you're a non-resident oil field worker and you live somewhere else, all the earnings you had in Alaska will be subject to state income tax. If you're a tourist and come here, because of federal law, we cannot assess sales tax on the cruise ship or plane tickets, and that's a lot of what you spend to come here. So people are trying to figure out, well, how much do I lose from the economy with a sales income tax if I spend permanent fund earnings that were just sitting in a bank account in Wall Street and bring them back to Alaska to help pay for schools? Well, that's actually kind of new money I'm bringing back in the economy. So a lot of people trying to figure out what does the least harm and the most benefit, or a blend of all of them, because it's probably going to take pieces of many.
So what would take, I guess, looking at all taxes, permanent fund, all, if you have to develop the infrastructure to collect this money, what's going to be the easiest? Or the least expensive, or what's...
You mean between an income tax or a sales tax?
Yeah.
The Department of Revenue estimates you could put in a statewide income tax for about 60 employees. It would take about 60 workers to collect income tax. That's about the same number of workers it takes to process permanent fund dividends every year. So, I don't know. Some people will say, I don't want a big bureaucracy. I don't think 60 people is a big bureaucracy.
One of the other things that they don't talk about right now, at least in sales tax, because, you know, they say, well, the public supports sales taxes over income taxes. Well, maybe they do in a poll, but I think that's just because they haven't really analyzed it enough. And in Anchorage, for example, they don't have a sales tax. Their property taxes are 18.5 mils. I know, because we own some property up there. And for sales tax, the other thing that we've already seen is a lot of sales that have gravitated to the internet and online, because, not necessarily because of sales tax, but just because local vendors can't keep the same amount of inventory and choices that you can get by going online and clicking a button between all of the different choices. So increasing, adding a state sales tax onto the top of local taxes, and I think here it's 4%, and in the Kenai Borough is 3%, so it's 7% already. You add more on that, all of a sudden you incentivize more sales to be done over the internet. Now, you can, if it's a state tax, you can collect some of that tax that's from items that are sold online, but nevertheless, where it ends up impacting is in small businesses and entrepreneurs who are trying to sell same or similar items in the community. And so I think that's where you have to be careful about it. The other thing is that we have economies of scale in Alaska are just different than anywhere else, because we have by far the largest state and I think the third or fourth smallest population. So there's some very rural areas of the state, and if there's sales there, you have to enforce your sales tax code in all areas of the state. So going out to Bethel or Nome or Savunga or any place in order to do a sales tax audit or to collect on someone who's not paying, et cetera, going to be very, very expensive. And, you know, we administer a sales tax code in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and I think that they are grossly underestimating the problems that they're going to see with a statewide sales tax. But
it's also hard for businesses.
Mm-hmm. It will be. Well, and the other thing is that if they do it at the state level, it will probably be under the state mandate, so that exemptions, what they make, what decisions they make about exemptions will be the same ones. They'll eclipse our local exemptions, because I think there's 142 different tax jurisdiction across the state of Alaska currently, sales tax jurisdictions, and they're not going to say, well, we're going to manage all of them based on what your choices are at the local level. They're going to say, here's the sales tax, here's the exemptions, and that's it. And so it will significantly change the way the sales tax burden falls here also. We have a cap on sales of $500. I tried to change that too.
Looking around the room, I'm probably, I would guess, younger than a fair amount of the population here. What I was going to say was that you're probably a lot wiser, a lot more knowledgeable than I am. But I've been a lifelong, that was what I intended to say. I've been a lifelong businessman in Alaska. I started my own fishing business at 19. And in all the discussions, I wouldn't mind if you put up that one slide that showed the different places you want to look at taking, you know, the permanent fund and income tax, sales tax, all that. So as a businessman, I've been a contractor, commercial fisherman, whatever it took to put food on the table over the years. And when I sell my fish to processor, they pay a tax, fish tax at the dock. Whatever port I'm in, I go buy groceries, I pay sales tax there, I pay taxes. I go put my boat in a stall and pay moorage, which in essence is a tax for using the harbor. I come back to Homer, I pay 7.5% city and borough sales tax on pretty much everything. I'm not old enough to get the exemption for my property taxes, so my tax burden now on land that been privileged to be a part of a family who's lived here in this area. Both my wife's sets of grandparents were early settlers here. In fact, the museum's named after her great-great-uncle. For the privilege of living on land that's been in our family for 85 years now, we're paying an average of about $1,000 a month in property taxes. I pay taxes on the fuel I buy to put in my boat. I pay taxes on the fuel I put in my vehicle to drive on the roads. At every turn, I'm paying taxes, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. At every turn, we're paying taxes, whether we're business people or just regular consumers. And I agree, we need to have a broad-based tax plan. I actually came thinking this was about property taxes tonight, but I'm actually glad I'm here, because this is a much more important discussion overall. We're already being taxed at every turn as citizens of this beautiful state of Alaska. It's pure foolishness. An income tax makes a lot of sense. I see a lot of people, I employ a lot of people over the years that take their money and go south, they go somewhere else. I have a lot of friends that work on the slope, a lot of people I know, and they take their money and they go somewhere else and they spend it elsewhere and they're not taxed on it. So I don't have any heartburn at all about an income tax, even though I know I will be paying some. Like you, I have a corporation, so I do pay state income tax. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to have an LLC. So I'm paying taxes there too. And I understand the difficulty you're in as a legislator of trying to you know, you've got so many people, that picture of four people pulling different directions is really apropos, because you have people who are used to getting a dividend. They don't want to see the dividend go away. But we really do need an income tax. We do need some other forms of taxation. I think a property tax, because we're all of us who live here in Lower Peninsula, are, you know, some are happy because now they think the property is worth more than it is. Some aren't, like me, who had it assessed way beyond what it should be. So, you know, we have some push and pull there as well. But I know it could be really difficult to implement. I appreciate the difficulties of, you know, being in politics and having to deal with all the different persuasions. But to continue to add more layers of taxation on things that we already are taxed on, fuels and roads and all these usage fees. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm getting a usage fee. You know, I base out of Whittier part of the time. I got to pay $200 for parking a vehicle there now. Before the tunnel went through and we went on the railroad, everything was free in Whittier, you know. Once the road got punched through, we get charged to the hilt for everything we do there. So, and that's part of progress, I guess. So anyway, my thought would be, I don't have any problem with income tax. I don't have any problem with capping some permanent fund earnings. I'm not a real high proponent of people being able to become dependent on government for programs and things when they don't really need them. I worked hard to establish a business that I have, and a lot of lean years, I got to put my nose to the grindstone and work the whole off season, just to, so I have the privilege to go back to commercial fishing. So I think this state was built on people like that, like my father-in-law and his family who came here with nothing to Homer. Took an engine out of an old car and put it in a sawmill and made it work for the winter. And they took it out of the sawmill and put it in a boat so they go fishing for the summer. And they took it out of the boat and put it back in a vehicle so they could make something work to put food on the table and the roof over their head. So if I have my two cents in, you know, that's where it would head, is we got to get buckled down and go to work. And as individuals, but this overall blanket taxation on a bunch of different fronts, we're already taxed on virtually everything we touch. So to continue to add more to that other than maybe an income tax and a few other things.
Well, and I think that it is difficult to try to strike what that balance is, and I think quite frankly, what we're going to do over the next several years, until we get a plan in place that we can then fine tune, there's going to be a lot of turmoil and angst and political consequences associated with the choices that we make or don't make. Because my biggest concern is that if the economy is already contracting, I can tell you because we own restaurants in Anchorage and on the Kenai Peninsula, and it's contracting. The economy is already contracting, and all of the indicators show that. My concern is that we're going to spiral this down so far that it makes it much, much more difficult to make the choices. And then I can assure you that the likely what happens is the dividend does go away. Entirely, and I think the reason that we should still pay out a dividend is because in other states where individuals own their property and they find oil or minerals or whatever, they own that and they choose how they want to spend it in the economy. In Alaska, the state gets it. That's part of our constitutional structure, is that it's owned in common property, and so I think that is a good rationale. Despite the fact that most of the oil that was found was on the North Slope or in the middle of Cook Inlet or on refuge property or federal, I still think there's a good rationale for having a dividend that's just distributed and spent in the economy. And it has significant impact on the economy also. So But it's going to be difficult. You know, we're going to go through lots of turmoil over the next few years. And, you know, we have a gubernatorial election coming up next year. It's going to be important.
I really appreciate, I think we all do appreciate you making this presentation and providing us with all this information. Now, you've made a presentation, you've listened to all the questions. What is suggesting that we do at the grassroots level, as individually and as a group, to change the dynamic or get the message across that you're attempting to portray here? Any recommendations?
Well, my suggestion is that you put things on social media. If we pull this up, share it. To try to get the message out about the discussion that's taking place right now has to take place. Right now, there's still people who are looking for the easy solutions, and there aren't any. All of them have economic impacts and consequences. And the longer we wait to address them, the more difficult it is to get back to a level and sustainable economy. So I think we need to let our legislators know that it's okay to analyze these and talk about them, and that in the context of the economy, not more money for government to spend. Those decisions, there's a process in place for that, and it's a pretty good system, despite the times that we disagree with it. It's a pretty good system for discerning what our priorities are going to be in terms of spending, and those things are always going to be debated also, but we have a pretty good process in place. But it's about the importance it is to Alaska's economy, not just to fill the state coffers with more money. And if somebody tells you you can engage in discussions, you know, and we talk about 6 degrees of separation in Alaska. It's about 1 or 2 degrees of separation because we're a really small community. We get to see and visit with our legislators and with the people everybody knows. So help educate. I mean, that's really what it takes. And most importantly, and by the way, I haven't done this in any of the schools yet, but I'm going to, because it's important for the kids who are in school now, because it's that generation that we're talking about providing opportunity for.
I have two sets of angst on this. One is that, I mean, I'm totally supportive of an income tax for one reason. A third of our jobs are outside Alaska, correct? Isn't about a third of jobs now?
It's not that high.
Not that high?
Because one, you do hear that number a lot when they talk about oil field, but they're looking back at who got last year's dividend, which meant they had to have moved here in 2014. So you may have 30% new residents, because many of them became residents but didn't get last year's dividend. Is that making sense?
No, I think you lost me. I'm okay. Talking about people that actually live outside the state.
The current estimate's about one-fifth, about 20%.
Yeah. 20%? Yeah. Okay, but that's still a lot.
Yeah, his answer is much better.
That's still a lot. So we've got, so that's, I think to me that's a really good argument for an income tax, is that we have so many people, and like you say, they have to go home to their own state. If they're Minnesotans, they go back to Minnesota and they pay taxes in Minnesota on the money they earn up here.
We should keep them.
And that's crazy. And then the second thing is we're becoming a bit of a tax haven state. I mean, I think you know that with the big houses on the Kenai and our big houses on the hill. I met a guy who keeps a boat in Marengo, and he's a Californian, and he's established himself as an Alaska resident because he gets out of California income taxes. I mean, they were lawyers. They had it all figured out. He only had to spend 6 months in Marengo. Oh, my gosh. But anyway, so all in favor of the income tax, we're going to have to take some out of the permanent fund because it's the only place we got real money. But here's my two sources of angst. It looks like the House will come up with some sort of balanced plan. You know, there'll be some sort of income tax and some sort of permanent fund and maybe some dinking around with oil. Well, our guy is already the leader of that gang. You know, we can't do anything else about that. But then it's going to go to the Senate and they're going to kill it, because it seems like the Senate's only interest is in taking everything out of the dividend. They want to take it all out of the dividend. And that does affect people differently. It affects poorer people differently. It affects people with a lot of kids differently. It affects the Bush villages differently. And it affects, like, the small businesses who are used to that October buying spree. So taking it all out of the dividend is just like, oh, well, not good. But I think the Senate is intractable. So we're going to get there and it's going to be like a brick wall. Okay, my second source of angst that I don't know the solution to is we're just a very expensive state to manage, and we always will be. When they look at how much it costs per citizen, all those villages, troopers flying out to all those villages, public health people flying out to all those villages, school districts all over the place, we're an expensive place, a harsh climate, to manage. And so how are we going to pay for the state?
You've raised some really good points, and you know, Representative Seaton, I think, is trying to get to a balanced plan. But, that process is it takes 21 votes in the House and 11 votes in the Senate. And so it's a kind of a consensus-building process, and it's going to take some time. So I think the thing that we have to recognize is this is not a short-term process. It's going to take a number of cycles to get to rational and comprehensive plan. I think we need to keep that in mind. See, what's the other point that you were?
How do we pay for an expensive state?
Oh, how do you pay for expenses in a state? And that's something that I think a lot of people don't recognize. You know, the Kenai Peninsula Borough didn't just form because we wanted to be a borough. We were part of the Mandatory Borough Act in 1964. Which said that those areas of the state, in order to help offset some of the state expenses, those areas of the state that had a tax base, we're going to encourage you, force you, however, to become a local government entity in order to provide some of your services locally, and in order to provide for education and some of the other things at the local level. And so in other states, there are split up into either counties or boroughs, and every area of the state is in a county or borough. In Alaska, some areas of Alaska have zero economy or very small economies, and when an economic activity takes place, like up in Northwest Arctic Borough formed because the Cominco mine came online and allowed them a tax base. In the Aleutians, because of fisheries, landing taxes, etc., they were able to have enough revenues generated at the local level in order to form boroughs. And so where economies develop, local governments kind of grow up around because they have a tax. A lot of places in Alaska just don't have it. And you're not going to be successful, nor do I think we could do it morally or culturally, is try to force everybody. Well, it's cheaper to do it in one big group. Economies of scale in Anchorage are much different than they are out in Bush, Alaska. And make everybody move to urban Alaska. That's not a good plan, and you can't get there under any of the laws, either state or federal, nor should we. So, yes, economies of scale in Alaska are always going to mean it's more expensive. Plus, we do things at the state level here. In other states, they have county courthouses, and here it's all state. We do a lot more at the state level here, partly because we have such a big state. A lot of it just not conducive to being done individual pockets in local areas like it is elsewhere. Okay, that's
one question. So in the projections that you have for the budget cuts and income tax with the slide up there, are those just one year?
Yep.
Adjustment, and so with these projections, is there an estimated at one point where the oil production, if it does increase, is there a 5 or 10 year or 15 year projection that they will actually meet? And perhaps if the income tax is added, will they meet up at some point where they're not needed? And also the second part of that is, with an adding of an income tax, if it does and it has to flow that way, have they incorporated any of the amount of people who do live here and don't want to pay the income taxes and rather leave because they live here? And it's like, well, that's one of the benefits of living here. Why, if I'm going to pay this amount of money and the cost of living of Alaska on top of another additional tax, I could live much better in an Oregon or in Arkansas or Mississippi. My dollar is going to go $1.50 versus here it's 75 cents.
You know, it's really tough to get to that level of analytics on any of these. But the questions you asked about new oil and projections, yes, But again, in order to get new oil revenues from royalty or production, you've got to have more production. Otherwise, the price has to go up. And because right now there's a glut on the world market, and for the foreseeable future, it looks like there will be, in part because the U.S.'s production in shale oil, that means that the price is probably not going to fluctuate. There's probably more downside potential than there is upside potential. And so it means production. And in order to get production, you can't take too big a bite out of the companies, or it's a disincentive to them investing in order to get the production back up to where we have revenues that we can apply to when we need additional money. And because, you know, it's easy to talk about cutting the budget. I'll tell you one more story. When I was running for the mayor's office again in 2011, my brother Tim said, well, you're the only progressive candidate, so you need to say you're going to cut taxes and you're going to cut government. And I said, Tim, I'm not going to say that. Everybody says that, nobody does it. He says, well, you're going to lose. I said, okay, at least I won't go in promising something that I know I'm not going to deliver. And so, you know, the budget cuts are easy to talk about. But what the budget cuts that are taking place right now are using one-time fund sources, or they're shifting costs. They're not really sustainable cuts over the long term. And that's, you know, that's one of the things about the legislative process. And, you know, they know more than we do. And they do, because so when they say we've cut $500 million or $300 million or whatever the number is this year, a lot of people are going to believe that. They're not going to look below the surface to see exactly what happened. So,
just one quick point on the oil. So that $250 million, it wasn't so much a projection. It just says, gee, even if you increase your oil revenues 25%, that's the little sliver you get. So when you think about new oil and increased oil revenues to the state budget, it's not so much a matter of just getting one more new barrel. You've got to keep finding and producing more oil, just if you want to hold steady. If you don't have more oil, that oil revenue is going to keep dropping. So you've got to find, get the money to invest, produce more oil, just to stop the decline in oil revenue, just to hold steady. And then if you want an increase in oil revenue, that takes more investment. There is a company called Kalis. They say they found a huge field on the North Slope. Could produce 100,000 barrels a day. That'd be a 20% increase in oil production, but it's going to take them $10 billion.
At least, in 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years and 10 billion. So, new oil revenue, fossil fuel carbonization aside, would be great. It's just going to take a lot of investment and a lot of time to get there. Meanwhile, the decline continues.
But that's just like
I'm
a...
Well, not all of us remember the last time Larry Persily was in town talking about this when he was a deputy commissioner. He showed up for a public forum like this with Representative Drew Scalzi. Conversation was out of Land's End. Had some similarities to this. Makes Mike's point that this conversation is going to go on for a long time. 15 years before that, of course, oil was about $9 a barrel, and we had a period of recession of the kind that we're entering into now. But I have a question about what happens not to the dividend program, but to the corpus of the permanent fund if we continue to draw from the earnings reserve, which after all is invested with the corpus of the permanent fund and is bringing income in here. And what happens, I heard Angelo Adell, the executive director of the Permanent Fund Corporation, testifying to a legislative committee, that with inflation at 2 or 2.5%, if you continue not to inflation proof, in 20 years, the fund has 50% less to generate the revenues that we're drawing on. Now we are actually drawing more money from our investments than we are earnings from oil itself. So what happens to the permanent fund if we don't inflation proof, and if we continue to take money for annual budgets out of the earnings reserve account?
We do exactly what you talked about. We erode the value of the fund because we're spending at an unsustainable level. We're not keeping the fund up with inflation, and over time, the real value of the fund declines. and it makes sustaining our economy that much more difficult. That's why they're talking about, as I'm sure you're aware, an endowment type approach to the permanent fund, where you take a percentage of the market value. You know, they're talking about a number that may be a little too high, who knows, but they're talking about 5.25% of market value on an annual basis, and then dropping down over a period of time, dropping down to 4.5%. That assumes, if you just take 4.5% of market value, it is assumed that the rate that you'll earn at will be higher than 4.5%, so it will inflation proof. But if it doesn't, because you have down years, and you're taking that percentage out of it, it's gonna erode the value of the fund over time. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. I appreciate it.